Anybody who's anybody is on the Talk of the Town with Tom Pace.
3, 2, 1, and cue Tom.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Rob. Okay, so now we are back officially. We're about 11 minutes after 5 o'clock. It's a Tuesday. I don't know why I've thought it's Wednesday all day, but I have. There you go. I love that clarinet. That's a sweet-sounding clarinet in that theme song from Law & Order. That happens to be the song that we use when Judge Scott Creighton comes into the studio. We've done that for many years. We will continue. That is his theme song, but more, it has to do with the very essence of it, law and order. And without law and order, we have chaos. So at this point, law and order is about our only hope. And Judge Creighton here in the studio, the Honorable Judge Scott Creighton, Caddo District Court, 1st JDC. And Judge Creighton, welcome in.
Tom, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, and I'm glad that you're here, Your Honor, because here's the thing. Everything seems to be going along fine. We still don't know when Nathaniel Code, the convicted serial killer, 8 murders that we know of, and I still don't know if there were more. But anyway, 8 that we know of. You prosecuted that trial back when?
Back in 1990, fall of 1990.
And after the successful prosecution, he was sentenced to death. Is that correct?
That is correct. We had a 23-day trial presided over by Judge Gail Hamilton. And it was a trial that started at 9 o'clock a.m. each day, consecutive days. It ended each day, or night rather, at 9 p.m. We would take off some time for lunch and take off some time for supper. And I believe we may have stopped at 6 p.m. on Sunday. But otherwise, we went to 9 o'clock every day, consecutive days, and it was a 23-day event.
And stop and think about that, ladies and gentlemen. These are the times that try men's souls is a famous quote from years gone by. Well, it tried men and women's souls as they were all trying to sift through the evidence and come up with either guilty or not guilty, and then whether it would be life in prison or it would be the death penalty. It has, and then became the death penalty, and let's say this is going on, is this the 23rd year already, or soon to be the 23rd year, Judge?
This is the 23rd year. He was convicted in October of 1990.
So this will be the 23rd year in October.
That's correct.
And so now, okay, so he has been incarcerated. He has been incarcerated down at Angola, where only the worst of the worst are incarcerated, and now he is in he is on death row, and that sort of thing. And Judge, now he has filed a lawsuit. Was it he filing the lawsuit? Was he representing a group of prisoners down there? What was the deal?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, he, along with 2 other death row inmates, Elsie Ball and James McGee, filed a lawsuit against James LeBlanc, Secretary of the Louisiana Department of Corrections, and also Burl Kane, who is the warden of Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. And he made certain federal claims. He, along with Elsie Ball and James McGee, complained about a number of things. His causes of action are under the 8th Amendment and 14th Amendments of the United States Constitution, as well as his claim being one under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And it basically is that it is too hot on death row, and that violates his Eighth Amendment rights against cruel and unusual punishment. He claims that his Code is 57 years old.
This is Nathaniel Code, the convicted serial killer from Caddo Parish here, Shreveport.
Right. That's right. He claims that he suffers from hypertension,
mm-hmm.
that he takes a diuretic medication,
mm-hmm.
And that he also has hepatitis,
mm-hmm.
and suffers from obesity. Apparently, they feed death row inmates pretty well down at Angola. He claims that due to the heat, he is occasionally dizzy and lightheaded. He has occasional headaches. He is sensitive to light. He has some sweating, profuse sweating, he says, numbness in the hands, dehydration, loss of concentration. He suffers from joint pain and inability to sleep.
Well, my comment is one of not to be taken flippantly, but factually. If he had not filed so many appeals, he would not be on death row. He would be pushing up daisies.
Well, that is correct. He had a right to seek appellate review, and he actually went from Caddo District Court once his death penalty was rendered, and Judge Hamilton sentenced him in accordance with the recommendation of the jury. Nathaniel Code then sought appellate review directly to the Louisiana Supreme Court in New Orleans. Of course, that is his absolute right. And that is what he did. The transcript was so voluminous, Tom, that it took about a year for the court reporter to complete that. Again, it was 23 days, and about 12 hours a day, minus a little bit of time for lunch and supper. And so it took a little bit of time to get the transcript and the record on appeal prepared and lodged with the Supreme Court of Louisiana. And then it took some time for the Supreme Court justices down there to review the record. They had to review the entire record. That would include all pretrial motions that had been filed. They would have to review the entire trial transcript, and they would have to review all the briefs, review all the law that he had cited, and that is exactly what they did. And notwithstanding the voluminous nature of that task, the Louisiana Supreme Court promptly, I think, very, very efficiently, issued ruling in 1993. Now, again, the case was tried by jury in the fall of 1990, so we have a reasonably prompt, considering the voluminous transcript,
yes.
We have a reasonably prompt, detailed opinion from the Louisiana Supreme Court in 1993, and it was, by the way, unanimous. There was no issue upon which the justices had any problem whatsoever. It was a clean trial. I will never forget on the 23rd day when the death verdict came in and the courtroom was ultimately cleared, the lawyer for Nathaniel Code, whose name is John Michael Lawrence, held out his hand, shook my hand, and told me that I had done an excellent job. That's really what lawyers should do. We are gladiators during the battle of the case, but at the end of the case, we remain professionals. And at the end of that case, he shook my hand, congratulated me on the successful outcome of the case, and he told me that it had been tried by the book, that it was a textbook example of how a case should be tried. And that, to me, is one of the best compliments that I've ever received.
Now, this is the defense attorney Nathaniel Code telling you, as the ADA that was prosecuting the case, That you had done, by the book, a good job.
That's correct. And he had been a gladiator for 23 days. He fought every bit of evidence. He fought hard for his client, Nathaniel Code, notwithstanding what it was proven that he did, which is that he is a serial killer and had systematically and methodically killed 8 people in the Cedar Grove area of Shreveport, Louisiana, between 1984 and 1987. That was proven well beyond a reasonable doubt, and John Michael Lawrence was a formidable opponent, a gladiator for his client. But at the end of the process, and at the end of that 23rd day, he gave me that compliment. I will never forget it.
And so all this is said, and again, we're talking with Caddo District court judge Scott Creighton. But back then, he was Caddo Assistant DA Scott Creighton prosecuting the Code case. Was that your last case?
That was my last case. You know, Tom, I started in 1980, fresh out of law school, completely green, I might point out, with a traffic case, which I successfully handled. I think it was a failure to yield or failure to stop at a stop sign. I can't remember which, but I won that because I prepared.
Yeah, of course
that was my
did.
First day on the job.
We know how you
are. My last day on the job 10 years later was the successful prosecution of Nathaniel Code. Now, what makes Nathaniel Code so interesting to me is that he killed people between 1984 and 1987, a three-year period of time during which he broke into houses. There were basically home invasions, and in the first house, that was Deborah Ford. That occurred in August of 1984. She was a single mother who lived at 315 East 74th Street. Then, and of course, George McCormick, then the coroner said and told police, the person who did this will strike again. The crime was so vicious, so brutal, so grisly, so completely ruthless that this guy will strike again. And those words really were prophetic in that July 19, 1985, he did strike again, this time at 213 East 72nd Street, again, of course, well within Cedar Grove. And he there killed Vivian Cheney, her boyfriend, Billy Joe Harris, her brother, Jerry Culbert, and her daughter, Carletha Culbert. Carletha was 14. There were two other children in the house. They hid in the closet and remained apparently unnoticed by Code. They hid out, and fortunately they lived. And then, of course, Dr. McCormick, when called by police in his capacity as coroner, he went there and said, I told you guys in 1984 this guy would come back, that he would strike again. Here we are. If you don't catch him, it's going to be as bad or worse the next time. And sure enough, those words, again, prophetic, rang true. And in August of 1987, he broke into his step-grandfather's house, whose name was William T. Code, and he killed William T. Code. There were two boys that were there, Eric Williams, who was then 8 years old, and Joe Robinson, who was 12 years old. He strangled them and killed, of course, all three in that house. So a total of eight that we know. And that trial was every bit as grisly and vicious and horrendous as anything I've ever seen.
And so as we look at this entire scenario, ladies and gentlemen, this is ripped from the pages, if you will. When I play Law and Order, not only does it symbolize the television show so very, very popular, but it also symbolizes exactly what happens when you have the perpetrator and then you have the law enforcement officials trying to catch him. And it just turns out, as was said by the coroner, George McCormick, he would kill again, and so he did, but then it turns out that he would actually be in the crowd watching all of this unfold unbeknownst to law enforcement authorities.
That is true. Dr. McCormick told the police each time, I'm willing to bet you that Nathaniel Code, well, he didn't know his name, but I bet you the perpetrator will be out in the crowd outside the house, outside of each house, watching the results of his handiwork, because the person who does this has that personality profile. He's going to show up, and he's going to watch. And so the police did videotape the crowds that had assembled at the Ford homicide in 1984. They videotaped the crowd that assembled at the 1985 Cheney household. And of course, there were dozens of people out front that were out there. They videotaped the crowd, and they also videotaped the crowd that occurred and assembled outside of the William T. Code household in 1987. Nathaniel Code was in all three videos. It's kind of like, you know, you look at a picture of three or four dozen people. Where's Waldo? He was there. He was watching the results of his handiwork. Now, in 1987, he could not contain himself. He became excited and a bit agitated and made contact with police. Because of his peculiar demeanor, they inquired further of him. That led to fingerprints being taken, an analysis being done.
And ultimately finding a fingerprint that was in the house.
Well, a fingerprint that had been tied to the, that was later tied to the Deborah Ford
yes,
house.
Yes, right.
And a palm print later tied to the Vivian Cheney bathtub in which Vivian was drowned.
All right, so now you've got all of this. Now you've heard kind of the story on it. When we come back, we're going to let Judge wrap this up because we've already talked about him filing the lawsuit citing cruel and unusual punishment and violating his Eighth Amendment rights and all of this. And I just say, you know what, if he would have been put to death 20 years ago or 19 years, how many years, he wouldn't have to worry about if he's burning his hands on the bars or if all of a sudden he feels like he's overweight because he's eating too much. If the justice had been served, so to speak, swiftly, he would be dead and he would be gone. I know I may sound crass, but that's my opinion. And so if you have an issue with that, you're welcome to write us here at The Promise and let me know. Or if you have a differing opinion, you're welcome to come on to the broadcast. But I'm just saying he was found by a jury of his peers to be guilty, sentenced to the death penalty. He has appealed, which is his right. He's still sitting on death row. And now he's upset because it's too hot, and he's burning his little hands on the bars, and he's getting fat, and he has trouble with sleep, being able to sleep, and he'd just be taking a long nap if he would have been put to death the way the jury said. So anyway, there it is. Talk of the Town, it's 5:30, and when we return, we'll be talking with Judge Creighton about this lawsuit and where it's going to go.
Now I taught the weeping willow how to cry, and I showed the clouds how to cover up a clear blue sky, and the tears that I cried for that woman are gonna flood you, big river, and I'm gonna sit right here until I die.
Thank you, Dennis Bodie. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Bodie, you heard there, is our call screener. So anytime we're bringing people up on the air from wherever they might be, Dennis is the one that you'll hear his dulcet tones right here on The Promise. And it's 318-550-2000 is the number to call if you ever want to get in touch with us. Feel free to call us on our hotline. And we're also proud to announce that Caddo Crime Stoppers is a proud underwriter of our broadcast, and we'll be talking more about them in just a little bit.
Tom Pace on the radio, the talk of the town.
3, 2, 1, and cue Tom.
And thank you very much. I appreciate it, Rob. Now we're back in the studio and live with us in studio, Caddo District Court Judge Scott Creighton. We're talking about this this lawsuit, and I'm presuming this is a federal lawsuit that's been filed by Nathaniel Code, a convicted serial killer who's been sitting on death row down in Angola for going on 23 years in October, and he's alleging some punishment that should not be, or he feels is unjust, unfair, under the Americans for Disabilities Act. And Judge Creighton, thanks for being in the studio.
Thank you.
Now, just, I know it's their right. I know by the law they have the right to make these and file these motions. But can you explain how it comes under the Americans for Disabilities Act? And by the way, he's been down there going on 23 years. Why hasn't he been put to death?
Well, with regard to the length of time, let me offer a disclaimer, okay? When I was elected judge in December of 1990, I was sworn in shortly thereafter on January 1, 1991. And, of course, by our ethical guidelines, I could have absolutely nothing to do with that case. So the last time I saw Nathaniel Code was on the day that that the jury rendered the death penalty. And so therefore, of course, starting in January of 1991, I would have had nothing and did have nothing to do whatsoever with his case. So there was an appeal. We know that was dealt with in 1993. I discussed that earlier. And thereafter, he filed an application, what is referred to as an application for post-conviction relief, wherein he complained about a lot of things. He complained about ineffective assistance of counsel. That was denied. He claimed that the death penalty is unconstitutional by virtue of the federal law. That was denied. He claimed that the death penalty and the three drug cocktail that is used to inject a death row inmate was too painful, and therefore a violation of his Eighth Amendment right against cruel and unusual punishment. And for some reason, for whatever reason, it was litigated in some great detail about the conditions of Angola and the three drug cocktail and all that kind of business. I'm not sure why, Tom, it took, 15 years,
right?
Which, because it only took us 23 days to try the whole kit and caboodle of the case, but in any event, it did. And there was a ruling by the state judge, and that went up to the Supreme Court of Louisiana. They denied writs on that. And after that, so basically all of his state remedies are pursued and they're over. He's done with the state of Louisiana in terms of any legal redress that he can file for. Now, with respect to the federal system, however, the federal law allows a death row inmate to go into federal court and make whatever claims they want to make about the underlying conviction and death sentence, and that's where he is right now. Now, the good thing about the federal system is that they have a time limit. They have a time limit in terms of when the application must be filed, and I believe it's triggered based on the denial of the writ by the Supreme Court of Louisiana, and therefore he's already filed it. It's pending, and at some point the federal judge is going to rule, and they have some pretty strict guidelines. They run a tight ship over in federal U.S. District Court, and therefore the federal judge will be ruling on that, I think, very soon. Then he will have the opportunity to, I know this sounds ridiculous, but he'll then have the opportunity to take an appeal to the Fifth Circuit. It's not really an appeal, it's a writ, and it will probably be denied, I suspect, and he will then have the right to seek a writ to the U.S. Supreme Court, which I anticipate will be denied. It's already been denied once based on his state direct appeal rights. My point, Tom, is that the end is near for him, I believe. Again, it was a clean trial. There are no legal issues that merit any attention, and it will be, I believe, he will probably receive the punishment that the good jury rendered back in 1990. I think that will be done pretty soon. Now, let me also mention, you had asked me about the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Yes.
Keep in mind that he has all these problems. He says he's 57 years old and obesity and claims to have hepatitis and has high blood pressure and so forth and so on, a little bit of dizziness, a little bit of lightheadedness and all that. Well, he claims in part two of his federal suit, which, by the way, was filed in the Middle District of Louisiana, which encompasses West Feliciana. West Feliciana is where Angola is located.
All right.
And he claims that because the Department of Corrections, the Louisiana Department of Corrections, receives federal funds, as does other state institutions, because it receives federal funds, it is therefore covered by the mandate of the Rehabilitation Act, and that pertains to the Americans with Disabilities law. The Rehabilitation Act requires recipients of federal money to reasonably accommodate persons with disabilities in their facilities, programs, activities, and services, and to reasonably modify such facilities, services, and programs to accomplish that purpose. And he claims, therefore, that because of his ailments, his impairments, that he is disabled, that Angola receives federal funds and is therefore covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act, and it must conform with the law regarding Americans with disabilities. And that's sort of his claim. Now, one thing about Nathaniel Code is he's not mentally retarded. He's been tested and retested and tested endlessly, and he is well within normal range in terms of IQ. I don't recall him having any impairments. In fact, he was a very fit individual when he underwent trial by jury, and certainly he was a very fit individual to manhandle and to viciously kill four people in the house in the Cheney homicides or three people in the house in the William T. Code homicides. He controlled them. He tortured them. He viciously killed them.
All right. Now, it's up to you. And if you have sympathy for him, that's your right. And if you support what he says, that's your right. I will tell you, I saw some of the interviews with some of the victims' families, and they all said to a person this very statement. He's upset because he's burning his hands on the bars and they're getting heat, stroke and possibility and things of this nature, and the conditions are inhumane, whatever he proffers. But the bottom line is, they said, all of the victims' families that I saw in the interviews said, in so many words, when he committed these atrocious, horrific acts, he gave up his right to really complain. He gave up his right to have a nice place, to have a house, to enjoy air conditioning and all of this. He gave up all those rights when he did these vicious crimes. So they have no sympathy. The families of the victims have absolutely zero sympathy for him. In fact, they are outraged that this motion has been he's put out there, filed to get relief for these conditions. And Judge, what's going to be the next thing on this motion, or where is this going to go?
Well, it's going to proceed through the federal court. However, again, this petition, which he filed along with two other death row inmates, you know, it's going to be dealt with. I can assure you that the federal judge will take appropriate action, and they will address this case and rule in this case very, very soon. I don't mean to exacerbate your level of frustration, Tom, about this situation, but just to put this in perspective,
I understand that
what he did in 1984 with regard to the Vivian Cheney quadruple homicide is this: he killed the two men in the house by shooting them and strangling and shooting actually one of them. He then basically he came close, like about 95% close to beheading the 14-year-old little girl, Carlitha, and made the mother of Carlitha, Vivian Cheney, watch as he sawed away on her neck. And the coroner testified that that the cut was not a clean cut, not that that would make any difference, but it was a sawing cut and somewhat of a clumsy method, and also some effort of strangulation.
So he made the mother watch while he was doing that?
Well, he did, and we know that because the blood of 14-year-old Carlitha was on the gown, on the backside of the gown that Vivian Cheney, her mother, was wearing. Vivian was later drowned in the bathtub in a pool of water, and we know that because she had a leash around her neck. I'm not sure I quite understand that, but in any event, she was drowned in the bathtub. We know that for a fact, and we know that Code did it. And the reason we know that is that there was a palm print on the side of the bathtub, as if the assailant, Nathaniel Code, is on the side of the bathtub. He's holding her down with his left hand in the pool of water, bracing himself and gripping himself with his right hand on the side of the tub. Now, we know that fingerprints, latent fingerprints that are left on any substance that's wet or that could get wet are not going to be there very long. They will disintegrate very, very quickly. in this instance, notwithstanding the fact this is a bathtub, that palm print was a tremendous, excellent latent print later matched to the palm of Nathaniel Code. Of course, that and other evidence tied him to these three homicide scenes.
I appreciate your candor. It is a horrific crime, to say the least. And not only that, the judge used the word exacerbated my anger, and it did. But notwithstanding this actual appeal or this motion that he has filed, appeal to get relief from the inhumane alleged conditions there, has really exacerbated the whole process. It's sort of like he's getting his cake and eating it too, although I think hopefully soon he won't be able to even taste anything. It begs the question, where is justice in our society anymore, Judge?
Well, it seems to me that this case is one that should have been more aggressively pursued following that 1993 Louisiana Supreme Court case, when they did an exhaustive review of the entire record and unanimously affirmed the conviction and the death sentence. You know, I don't cast aspersions at anybody, but this is a textbook example of the post-conviction relief application process taking an inordinately long time, an unreasonable period of time, and that's not right for the victims. These victims have had to suffer through this now for 25 years. Keep in mind, the first homicide occurred in 1984. Deborah Ford has a daughter, Nikki Ford, and Nikki Ford and also the relatives of Vivian Cheney all have followed this case, and they are horrified. They need closure. They have relied on the system of justice that we have, and they've turned it over to the jury and to the judges involved in the judiciary, and they expect justice a quarter of a century later. It needs to happen.
And so that is where it rests. Judge, you're going over to Caddo Correctional Center tonight?
I am. Every third Tuesday I present my program, Don't Let This Be You, and I usually have a crowd of 60 to 85 kids and their parents. These are teenagers, Tom, that may have some adjustment issues that adolescents have, and I talk to them about the law regarding a number of different areas, missteps that teenagers can make, the consequences of violating the law, and that's the first 90 minutes. I have to apologize to them in advance for having to listen to me for 90 minutes. I suspect that's fairly
That could almost be cruel and unusual punishment.
A violation of their Eighth Amendment.
There you go.
Rights, I might point out.
Yeah.
But the
but it's all good information because it can help make them understand that yes, under certain felony cases, they can be prosecuted as an adult, as in some cases, their peers and others that would be older will say, "Oh, if you do that, don't worry, you're just going to juvie."
Well, peer pressure is a real problem, and particularly when you're an adolescent, they want acceptance, and peer pressure is a dominant factor in their lives. You know, I'm there to say, look, you need to think before you act. My whole point about this program is that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I cannot tell you how many young men and young ladies have stood before me in criminal district court and said, "Judge, I wish I could take it back. I wish I could take it back." And so my answer to that is we need to have some education of these young people so that they think before they act. They know what the law is. In fact, the criminal code and the law says that ignorance of the law is not going to be a defense to any criminal prosecution. And my thought is, well, if you know, they're not going to read the criminal code on their own. They're teenagers, and so maybe someone needs to tell them at least the high points of how to stay out of trouble and understand that smoking weed is not a good idea, that it's illegal, that use of cocaine is a terrible, terrible idea.
And methamphetamines will rot your teeth out.
Rot your teeth out as well as your organs, and they need to know that. They need to know that hanging around with a bad crowd leads to bad results.
All right. Well, listen, I know you're on your way. Luckily, CCC is just kind of a stone's throw from where we're located here at the Promise Broadcast Center. But go ahead, go forth and prosper and tell these young people the pitfalls of what could occur. And hopefully somebody will get the message. I want to thank you for being in the studio today and taking your valuable time to educate us on, A, the issue with Nathaniel Code, and B, don't let this be you.
Tom, thank you. It's an honor to be here. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, we'll let him go with this.